This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, August 28th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Banff Mountain Film Festival World Tour will present a big screen journey from exotic locations and whitewater paddling to climbers reaching the highest mountain peaks. Banff Film Festival will visit Fayetteville at the UART Global Campus Auditorium on Thursday, September 12th and Friday the 13th. Tickets and more information are available at FayettevilleBanff.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we take a closer look at soybean research in the natural state.
Plus, as we begin a new monthly series, we talk to three of our local music hosts to learn more about why they volunteer to work on their show.
Those stories and more, but first, on this, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, we hear the voice of Arkansas native and civil rights icon Daisy Bates. For years, Bates promoted social justice causes throughout the South as a mentor to the Little Rock Nine and a leader of the Arkansas NAACP. Back in 1963, on that historic occasion when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech, Daisy Bates became one of the only women to address the crowd of thousands assembled on the National Mall in Washington. She was introduced to the crowd by March Director A. Philip Randolph as a great champion of Negro rights and freedom. Here is an excerpt of her brief remarks from that day.
The women of this country, Mr. Randolph, pledged to you, to Martin Luther King, Roy Wilkins, and all of you fighting for civil liberties, that we will join hands with you as women of this country. Rosa Gregg, my president, Dorothy Height, the National Council of Negro Women, and the Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, the Methodist Church women, all the women, pledge that we will join hands with you. We will kneel in, we will sit in until we can eat in any counter in the United States. Until we are free, until we can walk to any school and take our children to any school in the United States. And we will sit in and we will kneel in and we will lie in if necessary until every Negro in America can vote. This we pledge you, the women of America.
That was Arkansas native and civil rights icon Daisy Bates speaking at the March on Washington in 1963. We'll have more on the March on Washington later on Ozarks when we hear our 2007 interview with Al Kittner, who reported on the march for UPI.
Restaurants serving liquor in Rogers are now able to convert their licenses from private club licenses to licenses for selling liquor by the drink. That's after the Rogers City Council last night approved an ordinance which allows for such licenses to be issued to businesses in the city by the Arkansas Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Until recently, cities would have to hold a special election to allow liquor by the drink within their limits, but legislation passed by the Arkansas legislature this year allowed city councils to make such decisions. Rogers Mayor Greg Hine says the ordinance was not about encouraging or limiting drinking, but more about leveling the playing field for businesses in the city. In addition to allowing restaurants to purchase liquor wholesale, Mayor Hine says, at least for now, the businesses converting their licenses will have less of a tax burden as well.
Anyone that converts from a private club license to a liquor by the drink license, which is a license through the ABC, not through the city, once they apply to change that that permit, then they will no longer be required to collect private club tax. Now, having said that, I don't know if there's any appetite on the part of the council or anyone else at this point. But I should mention that there are provisions in the state statute which allows for the collection of a similar fee or tax on alcohol through the liquor by the drink.
However, the ordinance could also have an impact on revenues returned to the city.
If, say, every private club in Rogers were to convert their license status to a liquor by the drink establishment and all did that, say, within the next 4 or 5 months, we could see somewhere around $500,000 to $550,000 in lost revenue next year.
But that doesn't take into account potential sales tax collections from packaged liquor stores in the city, which won't likely begin until October.
The Fayetteville City Council will consider an ordinance to limit noisy construction during overnight hours. Jeremy Pate, the director of the city's planning department, told the council yesterday during its agenda session that the ordinance essentially sets hours of operation for noisy construction by private developers in the city.
And does not amend anything related to public infrastructure development by city, county, state, or any of our contractors related to any of those types of things, because oftentimes we actually have to choose late night for less traffic, things of that nature. So this is really limited to private development construction activity near residential areas.
Pate says the ordinance originated from complaints by residents about loud construction activity late in the night or in the early morning hours.
This does not prohibit all construction activity because there are obviously things that you can do in construction fields that aren't noisy. So it really, it's limited to those things that are noisy, and that's defined within the noise ordinance. But it does give a construction time frame, essentially prohibited after 11 p.m. and prior to 7 a.m. on most days. It's extended to 9 a.m. on Sundays. We felt that was important just because Sundays are the most common day that people are at home at their residence during the week. And so the mayor felt like we should extend that to 9 a.m.
The ordinance would also allow for variances to be granted if emergency repair work must be conducted after hours. A variance could also be granted if the scope of a construction project requires work to carry over into the designated quiet hours. The City Council will consider the ordinance during its regular meeting at 6 p.m. Tuesday at the Fayetteville City Administration Building. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals won last night's series opener at home against the Tulsa Drillers 5-1. There are three more regular series home games left for the Naturals, with the series continuing tonight at Arvest Ballpark.
Mostly clear tonight. Lows in the upper 60s in northwest Arkansas. Mid-70s tonight for the Arkansas River Valley. Sunshine tomorrow with highs from the mid to upper 90s. And tomorrow night, mostly clear. Lows from 68 to 75.
This is Ozarks at Large. Agricultural production represents a sizable portion of the Arkansas economy, and a major part of that production involves soybeans. In the first of two stories, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis takes a look at how researchers at the University of Arkansas produce soybean varieties that allow the state's farmers to keep track with trends in the market.
According to the Arkansas Soybean Promotions Board, soybeans are harvested in 50 out of Arkansas's 75 counties. Additionally, the University of Arkansas Extension Service claims that in 2011, the state produced more than 124,000 bushels of soybeans, valued at just under $1.5 billion. As it is such a big business in Arkansas, the U of A Division of Agriculture has a sizable soybean breeding program in place, and Dr. Po-Ween Chen is the head of the soybean breeding program at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Many of the soybeans planted in the state are genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Though genetics are manipulated in both GMO and traditional soybeans, Dr. Chen says that there is one major distinction that typically separates the two.
The GMO soybeans are developed with a new technology called herbicide-tolerant genes from different species. So this gene is incorporated in soybean, and then the soybean plant become resistant to the herbicide. And when the farmer applies to the herbicide to kill the weeds, but the soybean plants will survive. Non-GMO, just in contrary, has no herbicide tolerance genes, so they'll be conventional, developed through a very classical breeding, crossbreeding technology.
So in other words, GMO soybeans and other GMO plants are similar to the dinosaurs in the Michael Crichton novel Jurassic Park, in that genetic material from other species is incorporated into the host organism in order to nurture the desired traits. In soybeans, that most commonly means the plant is engineered to be resistant to commercial herbicides like the readily available Roundup weed killer. Herbicide-resistant plants allow growers to plant their fields and then spray herbicide to kill all the weeds, but not the crops themselves. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, genetically engineered herbicide-resistant soybeans have represented about 90% of all planted acres of soybeans in the U.S. for the past 5 years, but Dr. Chen says that the market is slowly changing.
The trend has been very obvious in the last 3 to 5 years. I think the consumer preference of their diet, choice of food, and becomes very important, and so that really drives this market to increase in the demand of non-GMO products, soybean included.
He says that because consumers want more non-genetically modified food crops, farmers can get a premium for non-GMO soybeans when taken to market. Sometimes as much as $150 a bushel. And that drive by consumers to get away from GMO food products is one of the reasons that Dr. Chen says that the U of A Division of Agriculture has developed two non-GMO varieties of soybeans.
These varieties are designed by crossing two different parents and picked by breeders and our team in attempt to combine the traits from two different parents. Mainly targeting for yield and disease package adaptation, stress tolerance, all combined into one.
Additionally, the two varieties, UA5213C and UA5612 as they're named, are bred for stress tolerance to the local environments of Arkansas. On top of that, the two varieties have high yields similar to some commercially available genetically modified Roundup Ready soybean varieties. Dr. Chen says that while the number of non-GMO soybean varieties available varies from state to state, he feels that Arkansas has a greater number of such varieties, either available or currently under development.
Because we have a greater effort in this area, in comparison with GMO product, it's still a small number. I don't know exactly, but I think it's probably 15-20% of varieties being tested as non-GMO in the state of our testing programs.
Other than consumers merely wanting GMO-free foods, there is another benefit to these new varieties, as well as for any other varieties developed by the U of A system. David Mosley, a program technician for the soybean breeding program at the U of A in Fayetteville, explains that the university is a public soybean breeder.
Basically how it works is if a farmer purchases this seed from the foundation that oversees the production of the public soybeans, they can grow them and then what's called brown bag, and they can save their seed to plant next year. That's perfectly fine when it comes to public soybeans. Unlike a private company, you would have to purchase the seed every year. So it gives them that advantage to be able to plant that seed, their own seed, the next year.
In contrast, seeds produced by private breeders such as Monsanto or DuPont are protected by patents, and those patents mean that growers can only plant soybeans purchased from the private breeders for a single season. And being able to replant seeds every year even applies to public GMO soybean seeds like the ever-popular Roundup Ready soybeans, which Mosley says the soybean breeding program is currently developing. But how does conventional soybean breeding work? Soybean plants naturally pollinate themselves for reproduction. Tina Hart, a research technician in the soybean breeding program at the Fayetteville campus, says that artificially pollinating plants to express certain traits can be a tedious process.
We use tweezers, surgical tweezers. You have to emasculate the female flower, and then once you do that, you can take a male flower. The female flower is a closed flower. A male flower is an open flower, so you take the pollen from the male flower and insert it into the female.
To get a desirable sample of possible outcomes from the crossed soybean plants, the researchers make about 600 combinations, and each combination is tried about 30 times, meaning that about 18,000 soybean plants have to be hand-pollinated, all within a three-week time frame. Dr. Chen says that the soybean breeders do this every year to start developing varieties for the specific traits they're looking for, including the two non-GMO soybean varieties released in the past year.
This program probably started 5-6 years ago, and then we had a winter nursery and home station alteration to speed up the program. So those varieties were ready to release for commercial uses last year, and it's one of the issue.
Though UA5213C was released in July and UA5612 was released last year, David Mosley says that the breeding program is already working on other non-GMO soybean varieties.
Some of the most popular kind is tofu, soy milk, and edamame. That's increasingly becoming more and more popular in the United States and Arkansas also. And you may have heard of the plant in mulberry. So here in the River Valley, there's production. Last year was 900 acres of edamame, and it's increasing this year to almost double, right? 1,800 acres of edamame. So we're trying to support that industry.
Mosley says that specifically, they're trying to breed for bigger seeds with higher sugar content so that the soybeans are better for edamame production. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Now, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to Mulberry, Arkansas, where a new facility is processing a certain variety of Arkansas-grown, non-GMO soybeans into edamame, a popular savory appetizer and snack.
Truckloads of freshly harvested soybeans, newly developed by University of Arkansas research scientists as a culinary vegetable, end up here at American Vegetable Soybean and Edamame in Mulberry. The pods are loaded onto a state-of-the-art conveyor system for automated sorting and cleaning. A few line workers keep an eye out for debris and undo tangled clusters as the soybeans rush by. The air is hot and humid and thick with dust. It's the peak of the harvest, and AVSE co-owner and CFO Raymond Chung is keeping pace.
We have 10-hour shifts, and we're doing day and night shifts right now, so yeah, we're around the clock.
The washed soybeans are submerged into a hot water bath and blanched. The conveyor pushes the steaming bright green pods through a portal into an even noisier and bigger cold room.
And is basically ready to eat. And what we do is we chill it using cold water. And after it's chilled, it goes up to a freezer, which the belt vibrates. It prevents the pods from sticking together. It's a process that's called IQF, or individual quick freeze.
After passing through the silver blast freezer, the icy vegetables tumble off the conveyor into storage bins, are sealed, then placed into cold storage warehouses off-site for future processing. Raymond Chung built the factory last summer with his father, J.Y. Chung, founder of Chung's Gourmet Foods, an importer of Chinese-manufactured packaged egg rolls, spring rolls, and edamame, taking a break from production in the factory conference room with a thrum of activity behind him. Raymond Chung said they decided to take a chance on Arkansas after learning that local farmers were willing to grow edamame soybeans. Most edamame consumed in the United States is cultivated overseas.
Our basic product line is frozen edamame, which is 100% USA grown. And it's non-GMO certified, I should restate that, non-GMO verified, which means that we've gone through the process. We've worked with this organization called the Non-GMO Project to make sure that all the seeds we use are basically GMO free.
Because, he says, more consumers are looking to purchase non-genetically modified foods as well as plant-based proteins.
We have the ability to process high volume of edamame because we sell to large customers like Costco and Sam's who demand product in bulk. And so the important thing about this facility is that we're the first facility to have scale. And we're also the only facility in the U.S. that is dedicated to producing edamame. And so we are turning Arkansas into the edamame capital of the USA, and we eventually want it to be the capital of the world.
Chung provides the Arkansas adapted edamame seeds to contract growers across central Arkansas. The company harvests the pods just as they ripen. Although he declined saying just how much edamame is processed annually, he did describe a big increase over last year, their first year. He said the demand for edamame is growing 10% annually. Simmered on the stove or steamed in the microwave and served with just a little salt, the buttery beans are addictive. Plus, edamame contains as much as 40% protein, is low in fat and high in nutrients.
And edamame's got a nice nutty flavor to it as well, which makes it, you know, very tasty. And kids like to eat it too because it's fun to pop the beans out of the mouth. You know, I get parents who come to me and they say, hey, I can't get my kids to eat any vegetables, but they'll eat edamame.
AVSE manufactures frozen edamame under the Edizen and Peggy's premium label in the pod or shelled and imports frozen pods from China for its line of dried seasoned snack products called Crunchamami.
And we realized that freeze drying is actually one of the best ways to make it dry, to make it portable, because when you freeze dry something, you retain the nutrients. And so The great thing about crunch umami, which is freeze-dried, is that the protein has not been denatured, and all the original antioxidants and vitamins are still in the snack, and it still tastes like edamame.
Edamame has vitamin E and isoflavones, which can play a role in reducing the risk of heart attack, certain cancers, and osteoporosis. The Chung family's initial investment in this facility was around $5.8 million, with help from the Arkansas Development Finance Authority and the State Department of Economic Development. The 32,000-square-foot plant lies on the outskirts of Mulberry, conveniently near the interstate, and employs up to 100 workers.
Actually, our project, the original factory project, is a great case study, I think, of how private enterprise and the government can cooperate to create jobs and also to create a new industry, create a new specialty crop for Arkansas. And it's a pretty substantial size business. Soy foods, the entire market for soy foods is about a $2.6 billion market. And this is ultimately what we're, the market that we're addressing with our products. It's a big opportunity.
Edamame, by the way, is a Japanese word meaning beans clustered on a branch. And the Chung family intends to grow this business, branching out all over Arkansas. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, August 28th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Have you recovered?
I'm working on it.
You look
I don't
good.
Know. Thank you. I don't know that I've ever fully recovered because there's always another thing on the horizon. So
you keep a pace that I cannot even conceive.
Yeah,
and it's not just because I'm old.
No, I can't conceive it most days.
Well, if you're up for a road trip,
I have quite a few coming up. Actually,
this is our weekly segment of events going on in the area, starting with indie rockers The Killers.
Yes.
Is you
that,
going?
I might be. Is that in St. Louis?
Yes, it is.
I will be there.
There are more than three dozen acts for Lou Fest, mm-hmm. a two-day event that takes place in Forest Park. The festival also includes sets by Wilco, The National, Alabama Shakes, Edward Sharp, and the Magnetic Zeros, who I know you love.
Yes, Ithi Agnihotri-Madoka was a big fan of them. And yeah, I will definitely be
Hi,
there.
Hi, Ithi, if you can hear us. Tickets for Lou Fest, which is September 7th and 8th, are $95 for 2 days or $250 for VIP passes mm-hmm. at loufest.com. Also coming up in Little Rock, September 7th, Don McLean is at the Robinson Center Music Hall.
Is he really?
Yes. Oh. American Pie.
Yeah.
Love him. September 4th in Tulsa, Steely Dan is at the Brady Theater. And in Kansas City, Steely Dan at the Midland by AMC, September 3rd. Iron Maiden at the Sprint Center on September 7th.
Okay.
There will be shrieking at this one. Not by us, but somewhere in our listening area. Michael Bublé is at the Sprint Center on September 8th.
He's a very talented singer.
And a funny guy. And Vince Gill is at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts on September 8th.
Excellent. So lots of things to do. Maybe I'll see you out on the road. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. The AMP, Arkansas Music Pavilion, presents Alabama Shakes Friday, September 6th. This retro soul band offers a mix of rock and alternative music. Gates open at 6 p.m. with music at 7:30. Tickets and more information are available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
Today marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, delivered in Washington, D.C. Hailed as one of the greatest addresses of the 20th century, the speech served as a rallying point for civil rights in the United States. The late Al Kittner covered that speech for UPI. When remembering the speech and the March on Washington, decades later, he told me the event did not begin as if it was going to be a monumental day.
People in the audience were getting jitsy. Some people were getting up to leave, and considering it a failure.
That was Al Kittner in February 2007 in Gravette, where he had retired from his journalism career. He was 93 when we talked. Just a few months before the interview, his memoir about covering the civil rights movement, titled March to a Promised Land, had been published. In a moment, we'll hear again in his words how Dr. King mesmerized the country 50 years ago today, with Al Kittner just a few feet away. But first, a bit more from our story that aired in 2007. Al Kittner told of how, as a young reporter for the UPI in his native state of Georgia, he was assigned civil rights as his beat. It was the day the U.S. Supreme Court had issued its ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education. Here is part of our report from early February 2007.
My boss called me in and said, I have a job for you. He said, I'm going to take you off of the regular routine in this bureau. I want you to get in your car and take off for anywhere you want to go in the South. We don't know what you do or when you do it. We just want the story, and we want you to get it as near right as you can get it, because this is a beginning of the greatest news story in America.
What did you think of that assignment at the time?
Scared. I'd hardly been out of the state of Georgia. I was scared, but I was also excited. I said, okay, I'll do it.
Al Kittner's beat became the civil rights movement. Now, more than 50 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, Kittner has written a memoir of his reporting in the South in the 1950s and 1960s called March to a Promised Land. Kittner is 93 now, and for about the last 20 years, he's lived in retirement in Gravette. This week, we met him at the Main Cafe in downtown Gravette to talk about his memories of the civil rights movement. He says his charge was to document how things would surely change in the South after Brown, talk not just to the newsmakers, but also to blacks and whites in small communities, literally on street corners and front porches. Kittner removes his bright red Razorback ball cap and narrows his eyes when he recalls one of those conversations he had on his new reporting beat. He says he was in rural Mississippi when he strolled up to an elderly African-American man sitting in a rocking chair on his front porch.
And we talked for a while. And I said, it's been wonderful talking to you, but I have a question. Where are the children? I've traveled many miles, and I don't see the children. Where are they? And he smiled, and he said, boss man, they's gone. They's gone north. They's gone to get an education. And when they get the education, they'll be back, because this is home for them. And sure enough, when some of them came back, things changed.
For more than 15 years, Al Kittner was at almost every important event in the civil rights movement. He says perhaps no day made more of a lasting impression on him than August 28, 1963, when more than 100,000 people gathered in Washington, D.C. Kittner recalls, however, that he was underwhelmed at the beginning of the March on Washington.
I got there early. There were a few stragglers standing around. And I was just about to phone my office and tell them this thing is not going to work. They had talked about 100,000 people coming to Washington. Where were they? It was only a couple of hours before they were supposed to start marching. Fortunately, I called the Washington police. They reported that every highway is jammed. The planes are jammed at the airport. This town has never seen anything like this.
He recalls that it was a happy time, a celebration, a day the New York Times said Washington was overtaken by a gentle army. The emotional highlight of the day for many in Washington was when Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his speech. Kittner had covered Dr. King for some time, and he anticipated a rousing climactic address from him. Dr. King, like many of the other speakers that day, read first from a prepared text, copies of which had already been delivered to reporters. Al Kittner says now he remembers Dr. King's opening oratory that day was something that it had rarely, if ever, been before. Ordinary.
People in the audience were getting jitsy. Some people were getting up to leave and considering it a failure. But Dr. King finished mostly reading that document. And when he got through, I was standing about 10 feet away from him. He paused a minute, he dropped that paper, stepped back up to the stand, held up his arms, and said in a loud voice, "I have a dream." Way, 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 way back in the audience, one of those typical sounds were heard that we often heard echoing something that was said. Somebody way back there called out, "Amen." And from then on, King knew that he had that 125,000 right with him.
One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech was delivered 50 years ago today. We heard Al Kittner's memories of that day from an interview he did with Ozarks at Large in February 2007, just a couple of months after the publication of his memoir, March to a Promised Land. Al Kittner died in May 2009 at the age of 95. This is Ozarks at Large.
With the Fayetteville Roots Festival occurring over the weekend, we've been talking a lot about music lately. Indulge us for a minute while we discuss it for just a little bit more. At KUAF, we're very fortunate to have a handful of volunteers who create locally produced music shows for our listeners to enjoy. For more than three decades, Mike Shirky has been producing The Pick and Post, which can be heard Saturday nights from 7 to 9 here on KUAF. Last Friday, Ozarks at Large hosted a show in front of a live studio audience at the Fayetteville Public Library to help kick off the Fayetteville Roots Festival. During the second hour of the show, which was not broadcast live, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums and Of Note host Katie Henriksen talked to Mike Shirky. Mike grew up in Stuttgart, Arkansas, and during their conversation, Kyle asked how Mike got into music.
I was a child of the 50s, you know, rock and roll. We did that a lot. In our class, actually, we would refuse to go outside at recess in fifth and sixth grade, and we'd dance. We'd get a 45 and sit up it and just dance. But there was a lot of music, of course, in the Delta. Oh, and I played guitar. A friend of mine, John Dillon, we grew up together. He's a founding member of the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. We started playing together. I quit, and he kept going. And Mike Acklin, Mudcat, was in our class, and we had a lot of music. And then I really started playing again when I was in Vietnam. I met this guy there who had been there 2 years, And he was leaving within about 2 weeks when I got there, and he had a Vietnamese guitar, and he said, oh, he was going to take it home with him. He said, oh, you want this guitar? And I was salivating. Yeah, I want that guitar. So I had time on my hands to practice over there, and so that's pretty much. And I also came across a radio station there out in the boonies that would just blew my mind. I mean, walked in where this guy was on the air and looked up, and there was mortar rounds hose in the ceiling. It was not a good place to be, but he was spinning records.
Wow.
I don't remember what little village it was near the town. It was very interesting. Anyway, I lived there in Vietnam with a bunch of musicians and artists, and just luck of the draw in a PSYOP unit, psychological warfare. And so then when I came back, I kept it up. I actually got another guitar through a fella. Sally Field's brother gave me a guitar. That's another long story.
Yeah, you're selling.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. An old Harmony guitar. Oh, I won't tell you what happened to that guitar. That's too depressing. But I busted over a rooster's head. That's right. So, anyway, that's another long story. But
I can honestly say that's not anywhere near what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah. It's true.
So your show is The Pick and Post. Let's talk about picking. And what's your favorite song to pick?
A lot of people listen, and we all hear these really hot pickers, whether it be guitar, mandolin, or fiddle, you know, and stuff. But what I listen to, and I try to get people to listen to, is whoever's playing a rhythm guitar. And I tell you who you can listen to that does that really well is Dan Crary. And, of course, Doc Watson. But Dan Crary really, besides being a great picker, he'll back off and, you know, play just perfect rhythm. And then he's got all these good pickers playing with him. And so that's some of the one. I'm trying to think of a tune particularly, but Salt Creek is the one that he just, you know, you can listen to it over and over and over again. And what's the difference between all these tunes? The names.
That was Mike Shirky speaking to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums and Of Note host Katie Henriksen last Friday inside the Walker Community Room at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Now, Mike is just one of our local music show hosts at KUAF. As part of a new monthly series, we decided to interview a few other of our music show volunteers. Each month, as part of this series, we plan to bring together three similar yet different people for a conversation. Yesterday, Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with three of our local music show hosts.
I'm Robert Ginsberg. I'm the host of Shades of Jazz on KUAF, and I've been doing this show for over 30 years. I believe it was 1979. At the time, KUAF was a 10-watt lab facility of the journalism department at the University of Arkansas, and it had a high percentage of heavy metal. And there was one guy who was the station manager who came on late at night who did a jazz show, and I became friends with him. I lived right up the street on Duncan, which is where KUAF was at the time. And we became friends, and he called me and said, man, I'm graduating, and if you don't do a jazz show, there's not going to be any jazz at all on KUAF. And that's how I got started.
My name is Paul Kelso. I do the Generic Blues Show Friday nights at 9 o'clock. I've been with KUAF 22 years. I took the every other Wednesday spot, rotating with or swapping out with Steve Wilkes, doing jazz on Wednesday nights. Slowly and surely, I kind of got a Friday night spot and been there ever since for about 20 years now.
My name is Daniel Estes, and I host Goodnight Jazz. And my story starts years ago when I worked at a natural foods warehouse, and my manager at the time was Paul Kelso.
I hired you. Got your first job.
He did. Short while thereafter, then after, I started on with KUAF as our office manager. And at the time, P.J. Hrabowski was our music director, and she hosted a classical music show. Every afternoon, we opened up the phone lines to the listeners, and they got to call in with their classical music request. My job was to run from the studio, from our control room, to the music library, in search of the Rachmaninoff, Debussy, Bach, whoever it might be, and back again just as quick as I could with the listeners' requests. While I was in our music library, there was a big wall of vinyl, just a big wall of thousands of jazz records collecting dust, sitting there not being used. And I always thought to myself, now there's the good stuff. That's what needs to be played. Well, in 2000, KXUA, the student radio, started, and I asked Rick Stockdale, our station manager, if I could play the records. He gave me permission. I started with the student radio in 2000, and Kyle Kellums asked me in 2005 if I'd like to come on with KUAF and play jazz on Friday nights. The pleasure of following Robert and playing on our public radio, it was just a given. Of course, I said yes. I've been here for 8 years now, spinning vinyl, Friday nights, midnight to 1 a.m., straight up jazz.
Awesome. Well, Robert, 34 years ago when you did your first jazz show, do you remember producing that first show?
I do. It was rough. It's a learning curve, pronouncing names. But doing a jazz show has always been one of the logistically easier than a lot of programming, because a lot of the cuts are going to run from 6 to 12 minutes, so it's not like you're a DJ on a top 10 radio station or anything like that. But I do remember, I was at a different time slot. I've shifted around. I used to be on Monday nights, and I can remember even when we were 10 watts, there was a guy who called me every week from Winslow, because the signal would kind of bounce in and out of the valleys, and this guy picked up KUAF, and people were hungry for it. In some ways, it's like being a musician without being as disciplined and working quite as hard, because you're sharing music, something that you love. But you have to be presumptuous to a certain extent that your taste is worthwhile enough that it's worth sharing. And, I mean, that's the same kind of presumptuousness that I feel like a musician has to have. They have to presume that they're good enough to share something that's worth hearing. And I think that all three of us would probably agree that when you have a passion for something and you know it's good, then that gives you the confidence to share it. So,
well, Paul, you said that you started out playing jazz,
right?
But now you're playing blues. At what point did you make that switch? Did you
as soon as he could?
Yeah. I mean, did you always like blues? I mean,
I did. Well, when I was 12, my parents let me see the Blues Brothers. That was a pivotal point in my life. I thought that was so cool, seeing John Lee Hooker doing that street scene and all. So I always kind of had that, something that I really kind of wanted to explore a little bit. So when I got the position doing the jazz, like maybe 6 months into it, and I started to, we had a blues CD library that was really starting to grow, and no one was using it. So I started doing, like, I went from 9 to midnight, and I do the last hour. I do that for a few weeks, and all of a sudden, I was doing 2 hours. And all of a sudden, you know, not even asking Rick, I was just doing 3 hours of the blues. And it is all kind of to taste, and it's getting a facelift, blues is. You know, as the old guys get die off, and these new people, they're taking all their influences and they're kind of putting them into a cake batter, you know, in lack of a better term. But it's coming out the blues, but it's really from what they've experienced, just like it was for the old classic guys who we, you know, that we consider classic, but they learned it from somebody. And they each generation puts a little, you know, their own twist to it.
Do you remember the first song that you played, the first blues song that you played?
I really was into John Hammond at the time, something like Preaching Blues.
He had performed a lot in town. He was playing down at the Library Club,
yep.
And he was kind of a regular here.
It was probably something like that, because I remember he was like B3. I think he was the third CD that we had in the blues.
B3. That's our cataloging system.
Right, just went right down the line. Yeah.
It was very complex. It was Dewey
Jazz Decimal. Was J.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Dewey Decimal System, Lookout.
And now we're trying to do digital, right?
CDs are becoming dinosaurs.
Well, and that leads me into, okay, vinyl. I mean, if CDs are becoming dinosaurs, what are the challenges that you face, Daniel, playing vinyl only?
Oh, it's a pleasure, and it's pretty simple. Just lift up the needle, swing over the arm, and drop it. But with as simple as it is, and I suppose maybe I can blame it on the late hour, I oftentimes, well, on occasion, I will miss the record. But that's part of the joy, whether it's just catching the edge of that record, or when you finally do get your aim just right and you get it down, just to hear that crackle and the pop or the occasional skip. That's a sound from a long time ago that...
Definitely.
But not often heard on the air, and a pleasure to hear for all the unexpected qualities that you'll get from a vinyl from start to finish, with good aim and bad. It's an added pleasure to the already beautiful jazz.
You guys all have day jobs aside from being a music producer for KUAF. How do you find the time to work this into your already very busy schedules?
It's easy to make time for something you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And unlike Paul and Robert, I don't make a playlist. I'll just thumb through the records, see which one catches my eye, put it on the turntable, give it a spin. If I like what I hear, I give it a go.
Paul?
I don't really give it all that much thought unless I have some kind of theme or artist I want to... really kind of introduced to, you know, our listening audience, if they're going to play locally or something like that. Kind of like Daniel. I mean, unless I'm doing some type of interview or preview for a festival, I just kind of look through the catalog and what haven't I played in a while? You know, how to just kind of mix it up.
I'll bet both of these guys would agree, when you've done a really good show, you kind of know it. You don't know why it happened.
Oh, when it works.
When it's a really good show, and I don't do playlists anymore. It's fun because the more you do it, the better you get at it, and the easier it is, and you can kind of, you don't have to spend a lot of time. You can, just like Paul said, something will happen. One cut will lead you to another cut, and oh, this guy's on this cut. Well, he's got his own album, and I happen to bring that, off you go.
Yeah. And actually, back to the question I really thought you were asking was, how do you kind of manage your show with the rest part of your life?
You know, neglect
work
the rest
and
of your
family.
Life.
Yeah, and it is hard at times. I mean, life goes on. Whether you know your show's gonna have a new show this week, you know, if there's gonna be a new show in that time slot or not. I'm as guilty as any. You got to play those encore presentations once in a while.
And you guys would agree. I mean, all of us are looking for those experiences in our life where we can shut off our cell phones, turn off the computer, and be in the moment. And that's what this is. If I can speak for all of us, I think that's what doing these shows are. It's that period of time where you shut the rest of the world out. You're not thinking about 20 different things, even though you have 20 different things to think about, and you're focused on, wow, I'm playing music that I love, and I'm going to share it with everybody. And
slowing down the pace after a busy week.
Yeah.
Just taking an hour out for music.
Right. So that's what compels you, and those are the things you fit into your life no matter what.
So you would just say that, you know, being passionate about the music and getting it out there, and, I mean, that's kind of what motivates you to continue
It's easy to take a break from music.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you can share music with friends when they come to visit, but they're talking, and... radio is different. I think that when you're passionate about it, it becomes the focus of the moment. And, in all of our best wishes, that's what we hope people, that's how they utilize our programs.
Yeah, it is just the love of it. And as things change, we just kind of have to go with it. I mean, we've had how many different formats of putting our shows together? Because I even have several interviews that are on Reel to Reel. John Hammond, we were talking about.
And, you know, think about what Daniel's doing.
Daniel, is there one favorite record here in the KUAF collection?
Usually it's the one I played last weekend. Quite often, with as many records as we have, I'm frequently coming upon new albums that I've never heard before. So more often than not, it's what I played last Friday after all these years. And we have some very generous listeners, too, that continue to contribute to our record collection with their personal collection. And boy, am I excited when I find it. And that's my latest.
Well, again, you know, this kind of comes back to your own taste to some extent. I mean, I think we all feel a commitment to help expand our own parameters in the hopes of expanding the parameters of the people that listen.
Well, and you get feedback, whether it's from somebody that would like a, you know, something on your show, or the guy years ago that heard it bouncing off the hills, you know.
Yeah. You do get feedback. Yeah. And we know our listeners. Mm-hmm. They're members of our community. We see them out and about. Mm-hmm. So it's more than just a radio show. Robert, I mean, you've been spending your weekend with the listeners for how many years now?
Yeah.
Paul? I've been at it since 2000. That's 13 years. It's a relationship that we share with our listeners. So we're looking forward to every week getting behind the microphone and doing what we do every weekend, talking to, playing music for our listeners.
Well, Daniel, you're on from midnight to 1, which isn't exactly, you know, it's not our highest listenership, we'll just say. You know, how do you face that kind of,
I mean? I speak to that listener.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the bouncer finishing his night at a rowdy bar, looking to slow down his pace, somebody who's already slowed down their pace and is tucking themselves in for night. I hear from a lot of listeners that are traveling. They listen to me while they're on the road.
I was going to say that we got a lot of people on the road driving back from somewhere.
Right. And then there are those that are just heading out for their evening. So,
not me anymore.
No,
never was me.
I speak to those listeners, but I keep it soft. I keep it mellow. I keep it slow because, for the most part, we're winding down our evening at that time of night.
It's good night jazz.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. It was fun.
That was KUAF music producers Robert Ginsberg, Paul Kelso, and Daniel Estes inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. They spoke to Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas yesterday.
Next time on Here and Now, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s history-making I Have a Dream speech.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Join us for live coverage of all the day's proceedings.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next on KUAF.
Support for KUAF comes from Dog Party USA, hosting its annual Dogs Night Out Saturday, September 7th at 6 p.m. This fundraiser is a progressive gourmet meal for the dogs and an evening of food and live music for their owners. Tickets are available at the door with proceeds to benefit the Humane Society of the Ozarks. More information is available on Facebook or at dogpartyusa.com. The Fort Smith Symphony celebrates its 90th year in Arkansas during its 2013-14 season. Season tickets are now available. Works include Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, Wagner's Ring, The Canadian Brass, and The Living Christmas Card. Tickets and more information are available at 452-7575 or fortsmithsymphony.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Decatur.
Why Decatur?
I was in Decatur before the sun came up this morning.
And we'll hear about that story later?
Next week, yes, at Crystal Lake Farms.
Perfect.
Yes.
Chickens?
Chickens.
Awesome.
Cute little chickens.
Cute little chickens?
Yep.
Did you bring one home with you?
No, I did not. Although I did taste one of their former mates before I left.
Oh, sad.
Yeah. Well, no. It was, interesting. And a beautiful sunrise coming up as I was going through Gravette this morning.
Well, good. Look forward to that.
All right.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Thanks so much for listening and have a pleasant Wednesday.